Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello, and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I'm going to be sticking with the theme of last week, and we're going to be looking at this civil unrest a little bit more. But in the last episode, it was a bit more heartfelt. It was a bit more reacting to the events as they unfolded, saying some things that needed to be said. In this one, I kind of wanted to look at more the hard practical realities. I've got lots of numbers in this, lots of graphs. What actually are the government's options? Why are they behaving like this? How strong is their hand? Spoiler alert, not particularly strong. So, economics of civil unrest. I'm going to start with perhaps the key indicator that I found predicting civil unrest. This is a chart that shows the red line is the growth in population, and the blue line is real GDP per worker. So, per capita GDP, or you could look at it as the income level per the individual. And for those of you who are listening, basically they're opening up like alligator jaws. So population is going up, straight up and to the right. The real GDP per worker, or the income per worker, is going down, straight down and to the right. And it's opening up an enormous gap between the two. Now, this particular chart is actually for Canada. Doesn't matter, it's the same chart for the UK. And I found a whole bunch of basically this indicator for a whole bunch of different situations, and go right back to the French Revolution, a absolute swathe of periods of strong civil unrest have had this chart. Now, I did think briefly about trying to mesh it all together and overlaying it, but it was the data was all in such different formats, it would have been a hell of a job to do it. So I just thought I'll take the Canadian chart and show you that one, because it shows it quite clearly. That gap in population and income of the population, it makes people a little bit fiery, a little bit up for civil unrest. Now, this is a sufficient but not necessary condition for unrest to occur. This is the perfect backdrop for that. But of course, you need the spark. And of course, we all know what the spark was in this case, and I will come back to that in a moment. But just talking about the population side of this for a moment, because I think that's also worth capturing. There has always been immigration. I'm going to give you figure two. This is population of the British Isles. And this goes back to, you know, the turn of the previous millennia. So this is quite a long data series. That first blip you can see is the Black Death, of course, or one of the Black Deaths. And what you basically have is a fairly low-level organic population rise. Black Death, a bit of a sharp decline, but a fairly organic population rise up until about the early 1700s, the advent of much easier modes of travel, and then you start to get this inexorable upper rise. So I'm just kind of making the point here that rapid population rise is not a particularly new phenomenon. It's been happening for many hundreds of years. Everything captured on this chart is going to be largely European, inter-European immigration. And actually, for most of this chart, it's going to be inter-British Isles immigration. You can actually see on large sections here, the populations of Ireland, Scotland and Wales declining as the population of England went up as it became a industrial manufacturing powerhouse. So population rise is not a new thing. But as you will also know from previous episodes of Brokenomics, there has been a long period of which productivity has gently increased over this same time scale, about, well, anywhere from between 0.5% to 1.5% per year. So even though the population was rising, the income per individual was also rising. So life was getting just a little bit better every year alongside the population increase. And the population that was coming in was as productive as the existing population, so you had that organic and genuine income level rise, GDP level rise. But of course, that is not what we've been talking about in modern times. So the country can absorb, quite effectively, significant increases in population. When those increases in population are sufficiently well matched with the population that they're integrating into. I now want to move on to figure three. This is a pie chart of 1981, the ethnic mix of Britain in 1981. And for those of you who are listening, the white population makes up 95%, over 95% of the pie chart. Asian, which I presume in 1981 would have been largely Indian, perhaps a smattering of Pakistani, but largely Indian, 2.7. Black is actually quite low, 1.5, and then 0.4 for everybody else. So in 1981, the country was a predominantly, overwhelmingly white country. And then we're going to advance this another 10 years to 1991. A modest increase. Black is up fairly organically from, 1.5 to 1.9. The Asian population, a stronger increase from 2.7 to 3.7. But the population is still 94% white in 1991. And I will remember 1991. I'm old enough to remember many of you. Some of you won't, but many of you will be old enough to remember 1991. 2001. This is after Blair has come into government. In 2001, he was still largely behaving himself. He was still largely sticking to the spending plans of the major era government. But by now, the ramp up in immigration was starting to kick in. Now the population is down to 87% white. And we're starting to break it out. And actually, the big new entrant here was other whites. Typically, that was Eastern Europeans. That was, by and large, it was Polish. 4% of the population. They rapidly caught up with the Asians. I mean, the Asians are now higher. They're at 5%. Blacks, a modest growth at 2.3%. And we're now getting mixed because, of course, immigrant populations tend not to mix generation one, generation two, they often will. So you're starting to get that mix come through and still a negligible amount of others. And that was the concern in Britain of immigration at the time, which is always worth remembering when you get these sort of leftist idiots telling you that it's all about skin colour and racism. Well, no, because there was a lively debate about immigration back in 2001, and it was directed at the rapid increase of Polish coming in. And they did sort of colonise a bit. I mean, my hometown of where I grew up, Bognor Regis, I have a mental image of the place. I mean, I haven't been back there for a long time. You know, I moved out when I was 18. But I mean, I have a mental image of the high street that I remember. And when I sort of briefly visit again now, the main high street is just full of Polish signs, Polish shops everywhere. I mean, the place has been colonised. So let's jump forward another 10 years. 2011. Blair has really had the opportunity to do things, and things are really starting to shift now. The white British population is down below 80% at this point. White other is now up to 5.7. But what's interesting is the Asians are being caught up on by the white other. They are surging ahead now, 7.8%. And the black is starting to show a respectable increase, still only up to 3.5. Mixed is growing all the time at 2.3. 2021. The white British are now down to 73%. White other 7.5%, the Asians very close to 10%, black up to 4%, mixed now at 3%, and other, because of course, you know, the doors have been fully opened at this point, so, you know, let's make use of that other category, 2%. But let's just stop and think about the remarkable change in the space of a single human lifespan. 1981, 95% white British. in the space of a single human lifespan, that has gone down to barely above 70%. This is a rapid level of demographic change. Now, this does not have anything to do with skin colour by itself, which is, of course, the lefty narrative, which is, oh, you just don't like people with higher melanin. No, no, no. That's not what's going on here. What it's got to do with is cultural change. Now, any single man who's ever taken on a woman will know about cultural change. You know, you have your perfectly sensible house with your perfectly sensible limited amount of furniture, and everything is order and there's lots of nice empty space everywhere, and then a woman turns up and suddenly you've got bloody soft furnishings everywhere. You know, your curtains were not sufficient. They need to be replaced with puffy, wavy curtains, and your single cushion, which was perfectly sufficient all of that time, now needs to be replaced with about 30 cushions and God knows what else, drapes and extra tables, far more crockery than you could ever possibly need, even if you've invited over all of your friends. But, you know, a big cultural shock. The difference with that, though, is that you chose it. You made the decision to take the trade-off. That is not what's happening here. There has been no popular clamouring for the sort of cultural change that comes with it. I mentioned my hometown has been largely colonised by the Polish, at least the high street. Swindon has apparently been colonised by absolutely everywhere. I mean, there isn't a dominant foreign ethnicity here. It is just people seemingly from everybody. And different groups integrate in different ways. And of course, it's affected by the speed of the integration. I mentioned in the last episode that I don't really have a problem with immigration per se, as long as it is limited, as long as it is, you know, the best of the best of the rest of the world. The native population of this country is about 50 million. Population of the entire world is about 8 billion. If we took the top 0.1% of the rest of the world, that means an extra 8 million people, I would be fairly comfortable with that if it was the best of the best of everywhere else. You know, personal example, I was friendly with a lad at university who was originally Ghanaian. Well, his parents were Ghanaian anyway. And Wayne, he described himself as Ghanaian as well, because he wasn't in for this lefty nonsense. And his father was an aerospace engineer who came over. I mean, brilliant, fine, don't have a problem with that. And as far as I can remember, he wasn't the only black lad on the campus, but he was, you know, there weren't many Ghanaians. That idea of taking the best and the brightest from wherever they may be in the rest of the world, in limited numbers, and bringing them here, I'm, you know, as mentioned in the previous episode, perfectly happy with that. But obviously you don't go from 95% white to, you know, barely 70% white by taking the best of everywhere else. You do it by fairly indiscriminate open borders, which is entirely what's happened. And people recognise this. They recognise the cultural shift. They recognise that the speed and the numbers are a qualitative difference of their own. So, you know, that Ghanaian lad that I'm thinking of integrated perfectly into, you know, what we all did, how we all behaved. It, you know, there was no incompatibility in culture there. If you bring over thousands and, you know, put them in a town, especially if they are from a culture which has a particular antithetical way of doing things to Western values, then they ghettoise and they don't integrate and they don't become one of the lads. Interestingly, I did know a couple of Muslim lads at university as well. One of them has integrated since, and another one of them has basically gone full Islamist since then. I mean, he doesn't do any of the things he used to do. He doesn't drink. He doesn't go out. He's, you know, he's just fully. I mean, he puts his wife in the whole thing, the hijab. You know, different groups will integrate in different ways, and not always will it be successful. So now I want to turn to figure eight. How have the British public reacted to this? Well, basically they voted to cut immigration at every opportunity. Now, this is a chart that's going to go back to, you know, the early 90s. My former colleague, Callum, did a segment where he actually went back to the post-war period. And at every election, the British public have voted for a government promising to curb immigration, and they've never done it. But this chart is a good example. Labour's 1997 manifesto stated very clearly, every country must have firm border controls over migrants. Not what they actually did. One hiccup in this is in 2005, their manifesto said that the Labour Party declare that a priority is building a strong, diverse country. So that is an example, a rare example of when a political party has won with a very soft claim on immigration. But certainly from 2010 onwards, it has been unequivocal. So the 2010 Conservative Manifesto, Conservatives pledged to bring down immigration to the tens of thousands, repeated in the subsequent election and the election after that. And in the 2019 one, Conservatives pledge numbers will come down. These are clear, unequivocal statements that the intention is to reduce immigration levels. That Westminster has become unresponsive to the views of voters, not just on this, but a whole range of issues. But immigration is perhaps the issue where the people and the democratic and the elite are most at odds with each other, where their views diverge most widely. Now, partly I think this comes from a misunderstanding of the benefits of low-skilled immigration. I made the argument last week, and I've just made it again today, that I think the benefits of the best of the best, the 0.1% is obvious. Clearly there would be benefits to that, bringing in a limited number of very high-skilled people who can then integrate. Recent governments have got themselves into a trap through presumably a desire to avoid appearing racist, but they must treat everybody the same. They must make no assumptions that anyone is different. And therefore, if the economy is GDP per capita times capita, well, if you increase the capita, you must therefore increase GDP. Because everybody that you bring in, you know, that guy from Somalia, he must be equally as productive as somebody who has grown up their entire life here, is immersed in the culture, speaks the language, understands the social conventions, and has been fully educated. Clearly, that guy that's just off the boat must have an equal GDP per capita output to that original person. And therefore, you can then go on to start making OBR projections where you say, yes, OK, the debt has got excessive and we can't possibly pay it. But if we just bring in large amounts of new capita, then GDP will go up and our debt situation will become affordable. This is, of course, complete and utter nonsense. It has been demonstrated in more recent studies. I don't know why you need a study, though, to tell you this, since it's blindingly obvious. So incorrect assumptions about the benefits of low-skilled migration. That coupled with the changes to party structure. Now, what do I mean there? It used to be the case that the local constituency would select their candidate and then they would go off to Westminster. What happens now, as we've covered in a number of Brokenomics, is that the party selects a short list of candidates and then drops that on the constituency, and they have to choose between a couple of different people, all of who believe exactly the same thing. All of this has served, along with the way that the first-past-the-post system works, to basically insulate the political class from having to deliver on any of their actual promises. As a result of which, turnout in general elections has been falling very sharply over the last 30 years. It's a pretty much a down and to the right chart of, turnout at general elections because people understand that their vote simply doesn't matter. Farage managed to force what was essentially an immigration referendum in 2016 with the Brexit referendum. And he went on to win it. And largely, I think what happened there is people believed the Tories when they said that they wanted to honour their promises, lowering immigration, but they were being blocked by the EU. So the people handed them Brexit as this sort of great enabler, only to watch Rishi Sunak drive immigration to absolutely unprecedented levels. With those great hopes of these OBR surpluses in his mind, and the people at this last election, they destroyed the Tory party in revenge for the utter betrayal that they inflicted upon us. Conservative MPs, I think they knew that cutting immigration would require fixing things that they had broken. It would require curbing spending, getting the debt under control. The debt isn't in control with immigration. It's just that they had found an accounting fudge that enabled them to borrow more because they said, okay, well, we're increasing the capita and therefore we can afford the borrowing to get us through, you know, the next few months and the next few months and so on it rolls. So in order to fix this problem, I think Conservative MPs knew that they had to fix a lot of other things that they'd broken. They would need to take some short-term pain. They would need to cut spending. And also they would get some stick and not be invited to media studios. They would perhaps have some of their more liberal friends not invite them to dinner parties, etc., etc. And so they simply didn't bother doing this and thought that they could just fob their way through it. They were unsuccessful in that. So this is all of the background to the immense changes that have taken place in this country. Cultural, demographic. Let's get on to this particular period of unrest. Keir Starmer, the media class, were all acting as if people have no legitimate grievances whatsoever. Let's talk about some of those legitimate grievances. And I'm going to have to give you a very redacted list. And I can only start at 2005, otherwise we'd be here all day. So let's start with 2005. Central London bombings, the bus bombings. 52 people were killed. Bombs placed on the London Underground and on buses. The British public's response was outrage. There were no riots. The government promised that they were going to handle things, and they lied. 2013, Lee Rigby was hacked to death on the streets by two immigrants with machetes. There was outrage, but there was no rioting. And the government promised to get a handle on things, and they lied. 2017, the Westminster attack. And there are still traffic-stopping bollards on Westminster Bridge to this day. There was outrage, but no rioting. The government promised to get a handle on things. They did not. 2017, this is a big one. The Manchester Arena bombings. At a Taylor Swift concert? Kids, concert-goers, were blown apart by a bomb in a kids' music festival. There was outrage, but there were no riots because the government promised to get a handle on things and they lied. Same year, London Bridge attack. Outrage, no riots, government lies. 2019, London Bridge stabbings. People were outraged, but there was no riots because the government contained it and they lied. Before I go on, I'll give you a quick anecdote that kind of makes the point well. When I married the missus, we went to Thailand, some little Thai island, Koh Lanta, I think it was, for our honeymoon. There was a little sign in the hotel that said, you know, we urge patrons to not hire a motor vehicle because under Thai law, if you get into any accident, regardless of the circumstances, as a foreigner, you will be held responsible. On the logic, that if you were not there, the accident could not have happened, and therefore you are responsible. I've always wondered if that actually is Thai law, but it's probably one of those things that is, it would be treated as true, if not. And I've always thought, I mean, that's kind of based, isn't it? You know, even if you're driving along and you slam on the brakes because a kid runs out in front of you and somebody goes into the back of you, you know, you're still going to be held responsible because, you know, if you weren't there, that accident would not have happened. Another accident would have happened, but not that one, including you. The obvious point is that if we had not had such mass immigration post, well, post 1997, and even more so after Brexit, a lot of these attacks would not have happened. A decent number of these are second-generation immigrants. And I think when leftists make the argument, oh, actually, they're second-generation immigrants, well, I mean, all that makes you think is, okay, well, since we've rapidly increased the numbers of immigration, doesn't that just mean we have vastly more of these incidents 20 years down the line when we get the second generation lot grow up? And of course, most, the vast majority, will not do that, but some of them have and will. And like the Thai anecdote story that I just gave you, had we not have open borders, those attacks would not have taken place.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.